Hello, this is Ralph Garman doing the voice of Adam West, and you are listening to the Something Something Cast.
What is going on? What is going on?
Okay, here we go.
Welcome, everybody. It is time again for the Something Something Cast.
Something Something Cast.
I am James Hatton.
I'm Podcast Rob.
And I almost once again screwed up the intro because I'm super excited about this show.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy the way this whole thing came together. But this is like our third huge milestone episode in a row. We had our 4-year anniversary 2 episodes ago. We had our 100th episode last episode, and now on our 101st episode, we have an amazing guest with us.
Yeah, binary number 5,
as far as
episodes go.
He is, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it's what is very funny is we had a bit of a downplay because we put the Patreon on pause in just last week, so then we're ready to like sort of take a breather, and then you get this. And here we are. So please, Rob, this is your story to tell.
The gentleman that we currently have waiting patiently on the line for us, he is a star of voiceover shows such as Family Guy and American Dad. He is a movie actor in his own right, has been in a number of Kevin Smith movies and other films as well. And he is a master of the small screen, having hosted one of our personal favorite shows ever to have aired. We are honored to have Mr. Ralph Garman on our show with us today.
Yay! Yay!
Woo!
I love that guy. I love him.
Mr. Garman, it is a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for joining us.
Rob, James, thanks so much for having me on. What a pleasure to be here.
So, let's start with your voiceover stuff. That is some of the most current stuff that you're doing.
All right.
I know you have some friendships going on out there with people in the production world, Kevin Smith being one of them. How did you get into the voiceover part for Family Guy and for American Dad and stuff like that?
I do a morning radio show here in Los Angeles called The Kevin and Bean Show on a station called KROQ-FM here in L.A., and on that show, as you can imagine, the two main guys are two DJs named Kevin and Bean. And I am sort of the third microphone on the show. And I do character voices and celebrity impressions and stuff. And if you listen to Hollywood Babylon, then you've heard some of the kind of stuff that I do. I do that on a regular basis, Monday through Friday, on this radio show. And the nice thing about working in Los Angeles is that people in the business who are working are driving on their way to work. And they will often hear something that you do. It'll catch their ear. And they'll say, oh, that doesn't suck. Maybe I can use that guy in a project or two. So the casting director for Family Guy actually heard me doing some voices on that show, and she brought me in to audition for a role for Seth early on in Family Guy's history. And it went well, and we hit it off, and we became pals, and I've been on a regular, semi-regular, but almost on every episode of that show since I started working with him. So it's just been one of those things that came out of the blue. It was just lucky happenstance, and then became part of my life.
With that third seat on a lot of the talk radio shows. That's usually like funny guys, stand up comedians and stuff. Did you have a stand up background at all? Or
I dabbled years ago in stand up. I love the art form too much to suck at it, and I did, and I didn't really have the wherewithal or the courage or the love of it to work hard enough to be great. So I just dabbled a little bit, knew it wasn't for me because I always liked working with other people mm-hmm. and to stand up there by myself and to tell jokes just wasn't for me. I had already started as an actor. That was my background initially, was acting. So I started working with a sketch and improv comedy troupe for many years. And that's really how I cut my teeth in town. And that's what led me into the radio business. And so doing sketches and celebrity impressions and parody songs and things like that that I had been doing on the radio, that was sort of an organic offshoot of having worked with this sketch and improv comedy troupe.
Yeah, I'll say that having tried very few times in my life to do stand-up, it's a very different beast than writing a sketch or writing a narrative or coming up with, you know, or having a witty response ready. Writing a long-form joke it's an entirely different monster.
Yeah, and you have to love it because it's hard work and you will suck at it before you get good at it. And I had always been a fan, and I still to this day, some of my best friends are stand-ups, Patton Oswalt and Jimmy Pardo. And there's guys who are I'm close to who I look at with awe because they're great at what they do, but they also had the benefit of loving that particular art form. And so they were willing to put in the work and the dedication to get there. And I knew that wasn't my passion. So early on, I decided, no, it's not for me. I like working with other people. I like bouncing off, other people. And that's why improv sort of became my thing. And it still is to this day. We do a lot of improv on the radio. Kevin and I, our show, Hollywood Babylon, is almost exclusively improvised as we go back and forth. And it's, you know, the Joe Schmo show I did on television was an improvised comedy. So that's, for me, this seems to be my strong suit.
Now, you said you started off doing acting. Was there something when you were growing up in school, in grade school, junior high school, whatever, that kind of lit that fire in you that said, this is what I want to do. This is where I want to aim my focus at.
Yeah. I always had an interest. I'm not sure where that comes from. But I was doing plays as early as grade school and then started continuing on through junior high and high school and college. Always loved it. Always loved being on stage. Always loved performing. And it was just a love that I had.
Is it having done stage stuff? There's a big difference between getting that instant gratification from the audience right away, based off of something that you're doing, than doing a movie or a voiceover where, you know, it's you do it, and then you don't know how people are going to react to it, you know, sometimes for quite a while. Is there one of those that you prefer? Do you prefer doing it in a recording booth and then putting it on the shelf and letting everybody else master it and put it together? Or, it, you know, do you really jones for that live interaction?
No, the live audience experience is just, if you're doing comedy, it's the best. I mean, you can't beat hearing that immediate reaction and that laughter from a crowd, and you know whether a joke lands or not. Well, if I'm doing radio, the audience is out there in their cars driving, you know, all over Los Angeles, and you hope that they're enjoying what you do, but you can't really be sure. So when Kevin Smith and I decided to do this Hollywood Babylon podcast almost 8 years ago now. Jeez.
Have you guys been doing it that long?
Yeah. Wow. It's almost 8 years coming up. I said to him early on when we were kind of hashing it out, let's do it in front of a live audience, because I hadn't done that in a while. I'd been doing radio for a while and I had gotten away from live performing, and I thought it would be fun, especially given our friendship and the chemistry that we have. I thought it would be fun to do that in front of a live audience and get their reaction. And he certainly had a ton of experience with his evenings with Kevin Smith and stuff like that. He loved storytelling in front of a live audience too. So we both had that in our background. So we thought together, unlike the other podcast that he was doing at the time, was just Smodcast, really, that it would be something different for us and it would set us apart and be more of a kick for us. Because originally that's how we started it, just as something for us to do for shits and giggles and to entertain ourselves, basically. So we went back to the old school live audience feeling for us. And it just turned out to be a blessing because we get so much material from a live audience and we get so much response from them. It's just a blast to do.
Yeah. I've seen Kevin Smith do a couple of his, you know, live chats. He did one. We're here in New Jersey. Right at the anniversary of Clerks, he had a big screener, you know, showing it on the sea, basically. It was on a huge projected outside. He does his, you know, hour or so talk before that actually runs 2 hours.
Yeah, if you're lucky, maybe three.
Yeah, he loves to feed off feed off that audience, and that was only two questions.
You got two whole questions in? That's rare. That's great.
I was actually going to ask, is there ever a time where you guys are doing Babylon where you kind of have to wait for that opening to kind of jump in? Because I've seen some of his Q&As that they used to have on Netflix, and I saw one that was an hour and 45 minutes, and he started off by saying he knows he talks a lot, he knows he runs long, he wants to get to as many questions as possible. And it was one question that this 16-year-old girl asked him, and an hour and 45 minutes later, it was, hey, thanks everybody for coming. Have you ever had that, like, you're gearing up and waiting for the moment to pounce for when he takes a breath to kind of jump in there and add your stuff in?
You know, I know Kevin well, and I know that is his modus operandi in a lot of other situations. But if you know our show at all, you know that just isn't the case. It doesn't happen that way. I don't know whether it's because I sort of drive the bus on our show, and I'm the guy in charge, and I'm the motor that keeps things moving along, and I usually present the information, and Kevin is more of the sniper, the guy who comes along and does color commentary to my play-by-play. But and people have said, fans of his have said, you're the only guy we know who can, like, hang in there with Kevin and not have him run over you in just the long-form conversation. And I think it's just our dynamic is very much more back and forth than he has either certainly by himself or with other people that he works with. So, no, it's never been an issue. Sometimes, I mean, look, I work with a stoner, so sometimes early on in the evening, we'll be having a conversation, and he'll go off on a tangent, and more often than not, I'll point it out to laughter from the audience, and we'll get a kick out of it, and we move on. So it's never a problem.
Very now, nice. Did you guys, having not heard your origin story with Kevin, did you guys meet through Red State, or was it prior to that?
No. Kevin used to come on the Kevin and Bean Show.
Okay.
When he would have something to promote, you know, he would come on our radio show to just make an appearance, as you know, would promote something on any other morning radio show. And when he started coming on, he and I just hit it off for whatever reason. And we became friends first. And even when I was doing, I have a recurring segment in the morning show where I do entertainment news with a sort of a twisted bent, like my own perspective. He would sit in on that, and we would hang out and talk together, and we always had a good chemistry both on and off the air. So when the situation presented itself to do a podcast together, we jumped at it, and that was the beginning of our friendship and partnership. And then Red State came after the fact,
actually. Okay. Because I remember – I do remember when I saw Red State, and like we've mentioned and we'll mention – quite a few other times. There's one specific show of yours that we'll be addressing shortly that Rob and I just love you for. And I was like, hey, that's Rob fucking Garman right in the front seat in Red State. It was so great to see you. And having seen, you know, episodes of House and some of your other stuff, Charmed, like anytime you do a character bit, I'm always thrilled to see that you pop up, you know, in the strangest of places.
Yeah, and a lot of that is from, like I said, friendships or weird connections I've made either through radio or some other gig that I've gotten. Or it's been an odd career trajectory, to say the least. And I'm just thrilled. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that when you see me pop up from time to time. I mean, I do these little cameos and these little character role bits, and for me, it's just the biggest kick because, you know, getting into this business, you always sort of project and imagine what you would have yourself be doing, you know, as a career. And that's what I always figured I would be. I figured I'd be a character actor. I would do these little things here and there, and that's how I would make my living.
It's a good living.
I never expected some of the things to happen that have happened, but it's so much fun to go in to a set and go onto a soundstage, especially if it's a show that I love, like House or NYPD Blue or whatever, and to get to work with those people and to show up and to work for a couple of days, it's just a blast. It's like it's TV star fantasy camp for me. You know, I get to go in there, pretend like I'm a real actor, and then I go back to my other stuff.
What would you say was your biggest, let's say, fanboy moment? Like you said, you're a fan of a lot of these shows, and now all of a sudden you're on the soundstage doing a cameo on this. Is there one TV show or one actor moment that, for lack of a better phrase, made it the most real for you? Like, holy shit, this is really me. This is really him. I'm standing in the same room as him, and we're going to do a scene.
There's a couple of those. There's sort of like an inner child one, and then there's a grown-up one. But my inner child one was I did a TV project for TV Land years ago that was me and TV's Batman, Adam West. And we got to work together on an hour-long special. It was called Living in TV Land, and it was an ongoing series where they took celebrities from former TV shows and wrote shows around them. And it was a special where I got to play a fanatical Batman 66 fan, which wasn't really a stretch because I am one.
Not a far jump.
Yeah, and we got to work together, and that was really the beginning of a long friendship that started with Adam over the years. And so that for me was one of those check yourself moments where, like, if I could go back in time and tell 8-year-old me that I would be hanging out and working with Batman and become friends with him, he would say, you know, well done. Like, you know, you can lay down and die now because you've accomplished everything we need to do.
Right. That was
one of those moments for me. And then the very first feature film I ever did was a movie called 2 for the Money, which starred Matthew McConaughey and Al Pacino. And all of my scenes were with Al Pacino. And I got to work with a guy who obviously we've all been fans of and loved since Godfather and all of his other films. And to work with him, and having been a guy who has, you know, kind of made a living making fun of him and doing an impression of him on the radio and other places, it was kind of crazy to be working with him and find out what a sweet man he was and what a just a class act he was. That was really a special moment for me.
Now, I know you've done interviews where you've said that Adam West used to call you and ask you to do your impersonation of Adam West for him, to which he would usually respond that sounds nothing like him.
Well, he would never do it on the phone. He would do it in person. If we were in a group, if I was, you know, I was his guy of choice when it came to moderating some panel where they were doing a reunion thing or they're doing something at Comic-Con, I would step in and moderate with him and Bird and the rest of the cast. And if we were ever socially out together or, you know, in a green room waiting to go on, he would say, "Ralph, do that impression of me that you do." And so I would bust some out and he would say, "Yeah, that sounds nothing like me." And it just, you know, and we would all have a big laugh, but he was the best. He's such a good friend of mine and such a great presence in my life, not only throughout my childhood. Not only did he create so many memories for me in terms of right and wrong and superheroes and introduced me to the world of comic books and things that became important to me, but also he instilled in me early on a love of television and performing and acting, and on so many levels he had an influence on me. So to become later in life his friend and to be friends with his family and his kids and his wife, it was really one of the great relationships in my life, and I miss him dearly.
Oh, that's there. That is a brilliant tribute. I wanted to talk to you just a smidge about Batman because you are a huge Batman fan.
Yes.
So was when you got to do the Batman 66 with the Green Hornet, was that like, how did that feel getting to put your finger, you know, dipping right into the Batman universe on such like on that classic Adam West Batman, writing his dialogue, writing the script, you know, your whatever your process happened to be. Like, how did that feel to go from being a Batman fan to now being part of the, in your own way, the Batman mythos?
Well, I'm not comfortable with you saying I put my finger in Batman, first of all. that bothers me.
That's a job only for Robin.
No, that was such a thrill. I mean, again, I've got so much to be thankful for regarding my friendship with Kevin Smith, but that was another opportunity that Kevin got for me because they approached him first and they said, "Look, you know, DC and Dynamite are talking about pairing up the characters that they own the rights to now that they've got the 66 franchise rights." And Dynamite had Green Hornet, and Kevin had written a screenplay for a Green Hornet movie that was never produced, mm-hmm. that became a really popular Green Hornet comic book that was done with Dynamite, and it also written Batman. They came to him and said, we're going to do a sequel to the classic Batman and Robin episode from the 60s where they teamed up with the Green Hornet and Kato. Are you interested? And he said, yeah, I'm interested, but that's really not my world and not my Batman, but my friend and partner is the guy, and we should bring him in on this. And I think it was DC who said to him, yeah, that's great, but can he write? And Kevin said, absolutely, he can write comic books, not knowing if I could write comic books or not. But he had the faith in me to bring me in and to give me the shot. And when he brought it up and said, would you be interested? I was like, all right, you know, what's the money? And he said, what are they paying? I said, no, what do I have to pay them in order to get to do this job? It was that much of a thrill and just such a blast. It was total wish fulfillment of getting able to take every thought you ever had as a little kid of what you would love to see Batman and Robin do. And then as an adult, make that all happen. And then also, I mean, I have been a writer. I've written screenplays and TV treatments and all kinds of things. To be able to write professionally and with some of my favorite characters in the world, along with one of my best friends in the world, it was just a dream job.
Yeah, just looking at the Alex Ross covers alone.
Ugh, right? How incredible is that work?
Oh, he's one of those artists. There's been a few times in my life where I've seen an artist's work live and in person. It was him, Will Eisner, a couple others, where I just see the work and I immediately feel bad about all of the work I've done in life. Just, oh, you already drew rain better than I'm ever going to draw anything. Thanks, Eisner.
Yeah, he's transcendent. Just Alex Ross is, and Ross Kevin Hall again. And I mean, I know I sound like I'm this guy's biggest fan, but he's such a great guy. He's such a great person. What had happened during the course of the writing of this? We had a deal where we had to do a six issue series, and Kevin, being Kevin, was spinning a million plates, and I said, give me the first shot at issue one. And then we can get together and you can give me your notes and you can, you know, take your red pencil and edit and change whatever you want to. And we can work together. But I'll do the first draft. And so I did the first draft and he looked at it and said, really, there's nothing really about this that I would change. And I said, OK, well, then I'll get on the second issue. And I ended up more or less writing the great lion's share of what got produced as that series. And so Kevin, being Kevin, sort of felt bad because we both got equal billing and equal credit. And he was very generous in terms of telling everyone who would listen that I was primarily the driving force behind that project. But at the end of it, when it was all said and done, as a gift, he got me two of the original Alex Ross paintings that were the covers for that series of books.
I was going to ask.
And those are two of my most treasured possessions, because not only because Alex Ross's work is brilliant and it's remarkable. You think it looks good on the cover, you know, you see it as his actual paintings are just ridiculous, but also because it came from my friend with, you know, such a nice gesture on his part.
That's wonderful.
Alex's Ross control of lighting and making paintings look realistic. It's almost unfair because he will never be able to paint a superhero that they could then make a movie out of, because the only place people like that exist are on Alex Ross paintings. And yeah, they will never look more lifelike than they do on his paintings. It's amazing.
And a lot of people are, I don't know, the photorealism, that whole style isn't for them, and they prefer, you know, Neil Adams or whoever their comic book guy is, the person that they worship. And I get that. And it's absolutely founded. And I understand that comic books and that kind of art is a different medium than photorealism. But when it comes to someone capturing a real superhero, if you will, in quotes, whether it's Linda Carter's Wonder Woman or Christopher Reeve as Superman or Adam West and Burt Ward as Batman and Robin, I mean, if you want a guy to draw those characters where those two worlds collide, there is nobody, in my opinion, that's better.
No, not at all. I completely 100% agree. So we touched on your Adam West thing and your Kevin Smith thing. I have to tell you that while watching you in Yoga Hosers, the scene where you're trying to come up with voices that the two main characters can relate to.
Yes.
Beside your German accent.
Yes.
Was hilarious because you hooked me on the first two or three that you did. But literally when you hit your Adam West, I had to pause the movie and take a step back.
That's funny.
Because it was literally so amazingly spot on that it was almost a little borderline creepy how good it is. That movie was a very entertaining movie.
I'm glad to hear you say that. We've taken a lot of stick on that film, and It seems like it's people's opinion of it is mellowing with age to a certain extent. The people are finding it a little bit later, either on Netflix or iTunes or whatever, are really enjoying it. Initially, Sundance and other places, we got beat up pretty badly over it. But we've always said it's a cartoon, you know, it's a live action cartoon. And when Smith cast me in that role, I said, really, do you want me doing all these silly voices and stuff? And he's like, but this is what you do on Babylon, and people get a kick out of that, and we can legitimize it. I mean, this guy learned English from watching old media, TV and movies and stuff. So it has an origin story, and it's goofy and it's funny, and people can get a kick out of it. So let's go for it. So I trust Kevin implicitly when we're on a movie set. That's his world. And if he says, you know, jump, I say how high. And I think in a lot of ways it is ridiculous, but it is fun.
Well, I mean, yeah. I was going to say that if you look at the stuff that Kevin Smith is sort of known for, the Jay and Silent Bob stuff, and then you look at his post Jay and Silent Bob work, he's just trying stuff. He's throwing interesting ideas at the wall. I never understood the hate for his later work. I think, you know, Red State's phenomenal. I thought Tusk was strange, but a super interesting sort of indie horror-y flick. You know, it's a very different beast. And I never understood the dislike for his post Jay and Silent Bob stuff.
Yeah, if Kevin Smith, I think, had made those three films under a different name, under an assumed identity, I think the reaction from a lot of people would have been very different, specifically Red State and Tusk. I think those films are such a departure for him that if they had come from another source without expectations baked into them, that people would have received them in a different way, because I think both of those two films have a lot going for them,
yeah.
Not the least of which is the brilliant work of Michael Parks.
I mean, yeah, if Tusk came out, he could use the pseudonym David Lynch, and no one would bat an eye.
That's very true.
I have to say, when I first saw Red State, I was, knowing it was a Kevin Smith film, it was, to me, it was almost refreshing to see him do something so wildly different than what he's known for. But you also can understand how, to a lot of people, that's putting on a wet bathing suit for them, because they think Kevin Smith movies, so they're thinking Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, stuff like that.
Right.
And when they get into this completely different color palette and different attitude of a movie, I mean, it's almost like, you know, when Robin Williams first started doing drama, nobody wanted to even be a part of it in the people who review them and stuff, because they're like, well, this is Robin Williams, he doesn't do drama. I think Kevin went through the same thing with that, and I think he did get beat up unnecessarily for Red State, because I think it is an amazing movie. If just for the movie that it is, it's a very fantastic movie.
Yeah, I think that it's kind of silly, because the people who wanted Kevin to do more of the same thing that he had been doing, I can't really understand that, because there's plenty of that to choose from. It's there. It doesn't take any of those films away. That's still there for him. And he was getting beat up by the same people who said that his early films were childish and inconsequential. And then he made a film that really had a strong point of view and said something about something. And those same people were beating him up for being not what he was. So, look, you can't live your life. And luckily for everyone that likes Kevin and likes his work, he doesn't live his life by worrying about what people are going to think, just because you make yourself nuts trying to please everybody, right? But he does films that he is interested in. I mean, he had pretty much given up on filmmaking before Red State, and then the idea of Red State sort of got him interested in doing film again, because it was different, but it was something that he had to say. And it was so funny, because it was early on in our friendship and our partnership working together when he came to me and said, I know you're an actor too. Did you want to do this film I'm working on? It's like, to be in a Kevin Smith film? Absolutely. Because I was a fan before I was his friend. So I was like, yeah, it's going to be great. This is going to be some wacky, funny thing, and I'll get to be silly, and I'll do my comedy shtick and stuff. And he explained the premise for me, and I was like, oh, great, I get to be a religious, fanatical, murdering, silent beast. Okay, that sounds like a joy.
Flash forward.
And,
yeah, flash
and
forward.
And in reality, it was one of my favorite roles ever, even though I don't say a word, which, you know, being as verbal as I am and doing so much, you know, voiceover work and stuff like that, to play a silent character is just, it was a trip.
Sorry for the interruption there. I was going to say, flash forward, you know, you sitting in a pew during Don't tell me his name. Don't tell me his name.
I'm going to tell you his name because you're driving me nuts.
I'm trying to remember Michael Parks' character's name, and it's killing me. Anyway, and he's doing his
Avon
big...
Cooper.
Thank you. Cooper. Well. Doing his big sermon, like, you know, dancing around, clapping and everything. And you just have to sit and think to yourself, this is the funny movie that you were going to be in.
Right, yeah. And people being encaged and shot, and it was horrific. But it was also, you know, for me... It was a blast. I mean, it was really acting school in a lot of ways, because I did get to sit in a pew and watch Michael Parks just go off and be brilliant, and it was mesmerizing.
He is a great actor.
Yes.
Even just his little monologue in the beginning of From Dusk Till Dawn, when they're in that convenience store, is just it's riveting in the tension that it builds up for all the chaos that's about to ensue. Very similar in the way he's got that quiet power about him, where it's almost like if he talks lower near a whisper, he's more imposing than if he were to stand there and scream and yell. He's just got that presence about him.
Yeah.
Really came out in that movie.
He's a pro. He was an old trooper. He had been in it forever, and he learned, and he was smart, and he knew that if you talked slowly and quietly, you drew people in. If you had something you really wanted people to listen to, you brought it down and you made them lean in to focus on you. And he knew all the tricks, and he was just a great storyteller. And he had so many fascinating friends. I mean, he was friends with John Huston and Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan and Lenny Bruce. And he would just go around telling stories. To him was just, oh, I remember this one time. And then you realize when he's doing it, he's not aware, but he is a walking history book, especially when it comes to the world of entertainment, not just movies, but music and comedy. And it was always a pleasure to be in his presence. And I was happy to have gotten to be friends with him as well. It was another really important relationship that I built.
Very cool. We're gonna get into the meat of our favorite TV show, but before we do that, we're just gonna take a quick break and step away. Ralph, hopefully you'll stay with us
so
we can talk about the amazing stuff that really got us turned on to you in the first place.
Yeah,
I will not be here when we get back. It's unacceptable.
So we'll
fake it. We'll see if we can clip together stuff that we've used already.
I was in this. We'll be right back. Do not go away. Hey, everybody. Sorry to interrupt the episode. We hope you're having fun with us on that interview with Mr. Ralph Garman. I am just reminding you that this episode is sponsored by audibletrial.com/something. If you sign up now, you get one free audiobook and all of the discounts that you would get otherwise, which is tremendous discounts on unending amounts of audiobooks, podcasts, radio dramas, and more. I am going to suggest to you this month, Tough Shit, Life Advice from a Fat Lazy Slob Who Did Good by none other than Kevin Smith, narrated by, Kevin Smith. So, if you've been enjoying this interview, I'm sure you understand why Kevin Smith would be the call to arms this month, but give it a shot. audibletrial.com/something. Thanks, guys. Back to the show. And we are back. It is me, Rob, and our special guest, Ralph Garman. Hi.
Hi.
We like to understate it.
So I have a question that I feel needs to be asked.
I'm circumcised, if you're curious.
Okay, that's
welcome.
The second question.
Oh, that wasn't it? I'm sorry. I should have waited.
I have friends in the area. You grew up, you know, you're a Philly guy, so you're
Philadelphia. Northeast Philadelphia, born and raised, love my cheesesteaks, my Eagles. Every Sunday I watch Eagles, and absolutely from Philadelphia, yeah.
Drink your water. So,
drink my water, eat my water ice, read his water ice, drink my Yingling beer.
So I have to ask you, around 2002, 2003, what the fuck was in the water in Pittsburgh?
Son, you got me. I don't know. Pittsburgh's the other side of the state. I'm a Philly boy, and it's a kind of a cross-state rivalry. I don't know if you really want to bring Pittsburgh up with me.
Well, the reason I bring it up is because it seems like that's where a good number of contestants for the Joe Schmo show were found.
Yeah, suckers.
In season one, it was Matthew Kennedy Gould. Season two, you had the both the male and the female were from Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And then in season three, which came 9 years later, I think he was a Pittsburgh native as well.
He was indeed. Yeah. Because I'm telling you, all the dopey people are in Pittsburgh. All the smart people are out of Philly. That's what I'm telling you. No, I kid, because I love all those people, and they're all good people, and they were very kind, and they did not sue us when it was all over, so that was a plus.
Oh, they were amazing contestants. Yes. For people who have been living under a rock and have no idea what this show was about, it was basically like a fake reality show. You had a bunch of contestants on a show that they thought was a reality show, but all of them were actors that were in on it, except for one person who pretty much thought it was legit. And was the original concept to let's see how long we can keep this going before they find out, or, you know, we're going to push through and try to keep everything under wraps until the big finale? How did the whole concept of the show come about?
Before we even get into it, I have to give all props to the creators of the show, Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, who have gone on to, well, you know, maybe a little bit more high profile success with movies like Zombieland and Deadpool and things like that. But it was very much a very, as loose as it was, as improvised as it was a very tightly devised premise that was supposed to play out over a certain number of episodes. And then there was a built-in big reveal at the end that was going to be sort of the emotional payoff for the audience and for the person who did not know they were on a fake reality show as well. So it was all not scripted, but it certainly had the storylines and the characters, and that was all very carefully beaded out before we got into it.
So with this show very specifically, Rob and I sometimes come across the fact that he and I, where we haven't been tight friends, we had big breaks in our friendship where we were out doing our own life. We come back and realize over that period of time, there are certain things that we were obviously watching at the exact same time and falling in love with. And one of them is very specifically, I remember we had a conversation where we were talking about reality shows. And I said, there was this little reality show on like Spike that I really liked. And it was, you know, this guy where he thought he was on. And just Rob chimes in, the Joe Schmo Show. Holy shit, I love it. that first season went as close to as perfect as I could have imagined you guys could have gotten it.
Yeah, it was pretty magical. And I think had it been on a network instead of sort of a fledgling cable, basic cable channel, it could have changed television, you know, not to overstate it, but it would have made a much bigger impact than it did. Although the people who saw it, like yourselves, certainly love it, and we're so grateful that for that sort of core cult audience that we were able to garner. But it really was a special time, and it all had to do with Matt, who was a special guy, and it just went as you said as well as we possibly could have hoped for.
It was for me at the time, I was, I'll say, anti-reality show. I had friends who were into Survivor and Big Brother and all this other stuff, and I couldn't wrap my brain around why somebody would sit there and watch a show like that. And then I stumbled across the Joe Schmo Show, and it was almost like the elixir for people who didn't want to get into real reality shows, because it was almost like a tongue-in-cheek kind of look at reality shows, but yet it was its own reality show in its own right, even more for the actors in it than for, let's say, the contestant like Matt. Because to see how you guys had to adjust off of everything that he did that you guys never expected him to do, I still can hear the communal gasp in the production room in the first season when you guys are doing that hands on a hooker thing out at the pool. And Matt's like, hey, I love you guys. I don't know that I'm going to hang out as long as everybody else, but I need my own bed. I'll sleep in the boiler room, and just kind of steps away.
Yeah.
And everybody's just, oh my God, now what do we do? And just had to jump into second gear about it. It was amazing to see how flexible you and the cast and everything else was to be able to roll with those kind of punches.
Well, there were plenty of those moments, and you're absolutely right. That show was a response from people who loved scripted television, especially scripted comedy, like Paul and Rhett and myself and John Holland Moore, who worked on that show, and a bunch of us who it was a response to all the reality shows that were happening on television, like Survivor and things like that. And at the time, we all thought it was a phase, you know, it was going to come and go. But it was a response to that, where we said we can write a reality show as well as these awful reality shows, and we can do it better. And on top of that, we're going to increase the difficulty factor, you know, of 9 by having improvisational actors be in the mix with this guy, and they have to keep their shit together at all times and not give up the game. You know, can that balancing act be achieved? And it was a question mark. Nobody knew. And so we went into it saying, we'll see. And we were blessed too. We had an enormously talented cast. You have to remember, it was Kristen Wiig's first gig. You know, mm-hmm. She played Dr. Pat on that show, and she was, just coming out of the Groundlings and had really not done much. And she was brilliant on that show. And Lance Krall and Dave Hornsby, there was just an amazing amount of talent out there. We were all working together, fighting to keep the show alive. And at the same time, you know, pull the wool over this guy's eyes. It was a ridiculous task, but at the same, and then be funny on top of it, you know.
You made a really good point about how it was a response to those reality shows, and then when you consider that it's not very long, probably even during when Joe Schmo is on, where there was a big sort of call out to the scripted reality shows, whether it's a Hogan Knows Best or something like that, that this was satire without even being satire. It was that so sort of second level meta.
Well, it was for us satire. For the network, it was a reality show, you know, and that's kind of what the guys did. They were smart enough to recognize that the premise was interesting enough and clever enough to sell as a reality show. What if we just have one guy who's on a reality show and we surround him with comic actors and he won't know, and then there's a big reveal at the end? You know, the studio suits ate that shit up. But the artistic end of it, that no one, you know, it was kind of our secret, we didn't tell anybody, was, but we're actually at the same time, we're spoofing Big Brother and we're spoofing Survivor, and we're sort of taking the piss out of them because we resent the fact that so much of television airtime is being dedicated to reality shows, and guys who are writers and actors and directors can't get jobs anymore. You know, it was that response to that, really. And then in the second season, we spoofed the dating reality shows with Bachelor and Bachelorette. And then later on, far down the road, as you mentioned, almost 10 years later, when we finally got around to doing a third season, we did a spoof on all those, career reality shows, like, you know, Apprentice and things like that. So it was, as long as reality television keeps exploding like it is, there's always going to be room to satirize it. And we were glad to be amongst the first.
Jumping back to the first season real quick, when the big reveal came out, you guys like had that big sit down on the couch and they had all their little confessional videos of people apologizing to Matt and everything. How much more was it there in person on the set than what we got to see? Because whole gist of it was, you know, you guys thought it was going to be a pretty good ha-ha joke. And then by the end of it, it's like, wow, we almost feel really bad because this guy's really kind of awesome. It had to have been a bunch more emotional, like, there on the set. As you guys were gearing up and filming that final scene, was there any, I don't want to say reservations, but was there any real severe nerves? Like, we have no idea how this guy's going to take it and what's going to happen and how to deal with it.
Of course, we had no idea how he was going to take it. We didn't know what was going to happen. And as you mentioned, on paper, it looked harmless enough. You know, this guy gets, you know, jerked along for, you know, 10 episodes or whatever it was. And then at the end, we reveal what's happening and we give him a big check and he laughs it off and he knows it was all good fun and he walks away and we all walk away feeling wonderful about ourselves. In reality, especially for the guys and girls who were in the cast, I mean, I was lucky. I played the smarmy host, so I was able to go in and out a la Chris Harrison or somebody like that, who could just sort of make an impression, you know, come in for a big impactful moment and then fuck off and go home and sleep in my own bed. But these people were, you have to remember, they were living these roles 24/7. Yeah. Anytime they were living in a house with this guy, and they had to inhabit those roles and be those people every time they were in his presence, whether the cameras were rolling or not. And on top of it, they also were making small talk with him over breakfast when the cameras weren't rolling. And they were hanging out with him by the pool, and they got to know his story about his life and his family and what his dreams were and what he wanted to do. So by the end of the process, when they realize they're going to pull the rug out from under this guy and rip away everything that he thinks is reality and show him that it's all been a play, in essence, for an audience of one, they were terrified and mortified and a little embarrassed and a little ashamed. And they really went through every possible emotion before that was all revealed. And then we did that wrap-up show, as you mentioned, and we talked about it. But trust me, afterwards, there was a long cast party that went well into the next day of just drinking and crying and laughing and apologizing and hugging. And there was a lot of shit to work out in his mind and in their minds. It was like one big drunken therapy session. So, yeah, we all learned a lot about the process. No one expected there to be such an emotional investment on the side of the professionals or on the side of Matt, who was our schmo.
I think part of it comes from the fact nobody probably expected him to be as much of a human as he turned out to be. Because there were some episodes where he kind of gave up prizes because he felt the other person in the challenge he was involved with would get more benefit out of it. So he was like trying to play this super ultra nice guy. I'm not going to be the greedy guy that tries to win everything because people still have to live their lives after this. And that has to have impacted the cast in such a huge way. Like, oh my God, this guy's so awesome. I am such a dick.
Yeah. The better, the nicer he got, the nicer he got and the better choices that, you know, the better choices that he made, the worse everyone felt because here is this terrific guy. But at the same time, I mean, in all fairness, he signed up to be on a reality show.
Sure.
So we knew at least there was that element of it, that he had a certain amount of, oh, I want to be on television and I want to win some money. And so it wasn't like, this wasn't a hidden camera show where this guy didn't know what he was signing up for. So right. that was always sort of our out, is that we knew at the end, yes, there was going to be some splaining to do, but also we were going to write him a big honking check and he was going to go home a rich dude. So we were hoping that, as always in Hollywood, that money would help take care of our guilt.
All right. So talk to me about season two. The female contestant started to figure shit out. You guys had to pretty much bring her on board.
Yeah, that was a nightmare. And not because of Ingrid. She was terrific. But two was difficult on a lot of levels because you have to remember Spike at the time was a brand new network. They formerly were, I don't even remember anymore. I think they were the Nashville Network or something.
Yep,
yeah.
CNN.
Yeah. And they decided they're going to rebrand and they were going to be they weren't going to be country anymore and they were going to do something else. So we were sort of the first project for the new network of Spike. And in terms of basic cable, it was kind of like a hit. It got a lot of media attention and got pretty good viewership. So the first season, they left us alone. The people at Spike had no idea what we were doing and really, frankly, didn't care. We were a cheap little show. We didn't cost them anything except for the big payday for Matt. And they didn't care. It was like this weird little comedy show that was happening, and whatever happened would happen. Then it turned out to be the biggest hit they had going in their opening season, and so they were really eager to do a second season right away. And so the pressure was on Rhett and Paul to come up with another concept. So they decided to take on dating shows, and then the pressure came from the network to up the ante. So instead of one schmo, let's have two schmoes. So we had a male and a female schmo, and that was all workable. But what the problem was is, as often happens with success, everybody takes credit for it, and so the suits from the network started showing up on set, and they started telling us what would be funny if. You know, we would have an idea going in and they would say, yeah, that's OK, but it'd be a lot funnier if this. And then they had a piece of pie instead of a sandwich. And we're like, that you're missing the whole point. That's irrelevant. Please don't give us any more tips. But they're the networks and what they say goes. And so there were so many people on premise who were just interfering with the process and coming up with what they thought were great comedy ideas. And these people are largely lawyers and accountants and they're not funny. So it was a brutal experience on a lot of levels. And it was compounded by the fact that Ingrid caught on, you know, with the help of some boneheaded mistakes from some of the cast members, what was going on. And we did have to fold her in. But I think actually that was sort of interesting because, and it wasn't planned, you got to see a regular person sort of brought over to the dark side and have them be now an improvisational actor when they really haven't studied for this. And that's not what they do. But she was able to hold her own. And then we brought in another schmo to take her place. So not as successful as the first one by any stretch, but I think also at the same time had a lot of stuff going for it, a lot of very funny things. I think the second season might be funnier than the first one, but not maybe as heartfelt or as successful as a social experiment, you know?
Her, Ingrid, being brought into the fold and, like you said, brought over to the dark side, I think was the absolute best twist on any TV show that year ever. Because when she started catching on, even as a viewer, I'm sitting there going, she, like, this, they have to, clearly they've put out an entire season, they filmed an entire season, so they have to have had some sort of workaround, but she's figuring this shit out. Like, she's going to give the game away. How are they going to fix this? And then you see you guys bring her into this secret room where everybody else is sitting, and she's like, oh, wow, what's going on? Yeah. Okay, you have two choices. You go home or you learn this script and you join us. And she didn't even, I don't even remember that she hesitated. It was just like, oh, I'm in.
To her credit, she was a gamer and she wanted to play and she wanted to have fun and she wanted to, you know, to have that experience and be on the other side. And, you know, it was our fault to bring in a contestant who was that smart in the first place who figured us out. But you're right. And trust me, none of that was planned for. We didn't have a plan B. We didn't have a, like, what if? If someone figures this out, what do? We were sort of arrogant coming off the first one that we could just pull it off. And yeah. So that was sort of created on the fly. It's like, well, let's give her an opportunity. We can either just, you know, jettison her so she doesn't poison the water for, you know, the other contestant, or we can try this experiment and see what happens. And I think you're right. I think in the long run, it did pay off.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, how hard was the vetting process to find people who weren't even aware of the first season to assure that they wouldn't see you and be like, I'm out. Never mind. I got things to do. I'm not going to.
Not that hard, really, because, you know, we were a success by basic cable numbers.
Fair.
Which is very different than the ratings bars are set for network television shows. So if we were getting 1.2, 1.5 million viewers per episode of the first season of Joe Schmo, that made us a massive hit in basic cable, you have to remember. But in terms of the general population, I mean, there's a ton of people out there. More people aren't watching than are watching. We were safe in that way. But they also took the extra bonus precaution of saying to me, how willing are you to fuck up your appearance so that you don't look like you? And I said, what do you got? They said, can you grow some facial hair? Can we dye your hair? Can we put in contacts? Can we put in fake teeth? Can you do an accent? I said, yeah. I said yes to all of that. So, you know, in the second season, I played a British guy who was coming overseas to host the American version of a British TV show. So we had a whole backstory built. And that was sort of set a premise for a template for my job on that show that we continued on even with the third one where I played a bounty hunter.
Was it Derek Newcastle who came in on the horse, the white horse in the first episode?
No, that was me. That was Ralph.
That was Ralph in the first episode.
Smarmy host. Yeah.
That was so awesome. Lap of Luxury, I think, was the fake title of the show. And you come walk riding in on this white horse and everybody was like, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Derek just showed up for a last chance for love, as it was known.
Oh, yes.
And then I got to ride up on a motorcycle as
Jake Montrose.
Jake Montrose. Jeez, I forgot my own character. Jake Montrose for the third one. Yeah.
Now, was there a specific reason that there was a 9-year gap between seasons 2 and 3? Was it just scheduling? Was it they had to wait for the first two to kind of bleed out of public consciousness?
There was a specific reason. The ratings for season 2 were spectacularly shitty.
Ah,
oh, that'll do it. Okay.
And no one watched. And so Spike said, well, that's dead. We won't be doing that again. And then it was dead. It was, the project was dead and we all said goodbye. And then it so often happens in this business, you know, nostalgia sort of gives you a rosy glow of memory in terms of what the reality is of things. And it was funny because Spike was, they had moved on and they were doing Ink Master and, you know, tattoo shows and Bar Rescue, and they had a bunch of, it was funny, they became the show, the network that showed the shows that we would make fun of, you know, when we first started doing this project. But they were pitched an idea of how would you like to be a bounty hunter, a real reality show for how would you like to compete to become a bounty hunter. And they were going to bring in a bounty hunter and have him put people through the paces. And it was going to be like a Celebrity Apprentice type show where each week there were different challenges and they would whittle away until the end. Someone got to be an actual bounty hunter and got a job with this guy working for him, sort of like Dog the Bounty Hunter and his wife. And they were going to bring somebody in. Okay. And the idea was batted around. No one was really in love with it. And it was problematic. And someone who had been with Spike, obviously, for a long time, said, you know what? This would make a funny Joe Schmo. What if it was a bounty hunter show, but it was a fake bounty hunter show, and we have one guy come in, and we do the Schmo business to him, but this time it's for a job. Instead of the first one, which was sort of the social element of Survivor and Big Brother, the second season was dating shows like Bachelor and Bachelorette. This could be one of those career reality competition shows. And lights went off for a lot of the executives. And I got a phone call from my friend John Holland Moore, who was a longtime writer on all the shows. Rhett and Paul had gone off to become big time screenwriters with Deadpool and stuff. But they had called John to see if he was interested. And I got a phone call from him, and he's saying, we're putting the band back together. I was like, really? After 9 years? So I went in and met with them. And originally, I wasn't sure if I was going to do it again, because the first one was so special to me. And the production on the second show was really difficult for me. It was a bad experience. And largely because of the interference from the network and stuff. And so they brought me in, and I really wasn't sure if I was going to sign up for a third one or not. And I was, you know, I gave them my blessings, whatever they wanted to do, but I didn't know if I wanted to take it on, because it takes a lot out of you emotionally. As you mentioned, when you're doing this to somebody, you really want it to be a positive experience, not only for them, but for you and for everyone involved. And so I was willing to listen, but I really wasn't convinced. And then they pitched the idea of a bounty hunter. And they said, you can be sort of like a Dog the Bounty Hunter character. And I said, I have one request. If we can make this happen, then I'll do it. And they said, what? And I said, I went to a mutual friend's wedding where Dog the Bounty Hunter and his wife Beth were there. And he was wearing a tuxedo jacket with no sleeves, with his giant guns hanging out. And he had handcuffs tucked into his cummerbund. And I said, this guy is a joke. I said, no matter what happens, can I constantly never wear any sleeves on anything? And they said, yes, we can do that. And I said, all right, that sounds like fun. I'm in. So we got into production again. And it was fun, just for the large part. The behind-the-scenes staff was almost all the same, so we got to get everybody back together again, and we found some super talented people to play the contestants, and just it was really just a blast on so many levels. And it was kind of nice. You know, a trilogy has that quality to it where you can sort of wrap things up, and it's a nice sort of button on the end of those shows, I think. I doubt we'll ever see another one, so to have that be the final one, which I think was more successful in a lot of ways than the second one was, that it felt nice to kind of wrap it up with that one.
The third one, it did have more of a kind of feel good ending about it, and less of a, hey, we're pulling the wool over this person's eyes.
Yeah, but we were also scared, because in a lot of ways, the Schmoes were very, they had a lot in common. They were both really super decent guys. And, you know, but we were lucky. This guy had a wife and a job, and you know, his wife shows up at the end, and it was just that we had a lot of things going for us that we didn't have in the first one. I think we learned a lot too. So I think we tried to make it a little less emotionally taxing, a little bit more celebratory at the end.
There was a lot more, you could tell there was a lot more homework done too, based off of having gone through the first show on what you guys tried to do and accomplish for the second and third season. I will say that there was a moment where you and the contestant in the third one, who's unfortunately his name is escaping me right now, but you took him out on a collar to bring in somebody who was a skip.
Yeah.
And he had a gun, and the people in the van are whispering, and we're seeing their text across the bottom of the screen. This guy's a hunter. Isn't he going to know that the gun's not loaded?
Yeah, and they were worried about the weight of the gun.
Yeah, that this guy hunts avidly, and you're going to give him a gun with no bullets in it. And I'm sitting there thinking the same thing as the text is going across. Luckily, I think, you know, the adrenaline got to him enough where he probably didn't notice at the time. But the third show was magical in a way that the second one wasn't. Not to knock what you guys did and all the work that you guys did in the second one. It felt like it had a different attitude about it. And I think you specifically and some of the actors and probably most of the production, like you said, since they were a lot of them behind the scenes were the same. They learned a lot from the first season in a positive way. And they went through a lot of negative stuff in the second season. So I think they figured out a way to marry them the best in that third season with all that time that had gone in between it. And the third season was something special, I have to tell you. When we found out that there was a third season coming on, there were many phone calls and text messages that went out to a bunch of friends of mine in very rapid succession. Did you guys see that there's a third season of the Joe Schmo Show coming on? And we couldn't wait for it to come on because we just adored the way the first two went. And it was such a cool concept and something that TV hadn't seen before.
Well, to answer your first question, we were lucky because Chase Rogan was the guy. Yes. Who was our guy. He was a hunter. You're right. But he didn't have a lot of experience with handguns. We found out after the fact. So that's how we dodged a bullet on that
good.
One. No pun intended. But you know what we realized after season two was that it depended on the kind of show you were doing too. The first show was a very social show because all it was about, much like Big Brother and Survivor, was forcing people to live together and to interact with each other and make hard decisions based on those relationships and what kind of response do you get. So you're forcing this guy to develop friendships and emotions and relationships with people that he finds out in the end are completely fictional. And that is a bit of a mind fuck, right? So that got messy. Luckily, we lucked out. It all ended fine. But that was kind of messy. The second season, it was even dumber. We introduced romance into the situation with the Bachelor and Bachelorette spoof, which, you know, didn't bother Amanda. She was, you know, she was not that into people at the end of the series. But Tim was. Tim sort of had a crush on Piper, which was sort of our Bachelorette on that show. And I think at the end of that, when he found out all of that was fake, I think his feelings were a little hurt, quite frankly. And we all felt a little bad about that. I mean, he got over it pretty quickly. But at the same time, he had genuine feelings for her and was sort of actually trying to win her heart during the course of that show. And we realized that was a bad way to go.
Yeah.
You have to remember with the third one, it was this bounty hunter thing. You know, if you get to be, if you win, you get a job with Jake Montrose and you get to be a bounty hunter and you win all this money. So it gave everybody something neutral to focus on. It was the money. It was the winning. And it took a lot of the heat off of the interpersonal stuff so that there wasn't so much betrayed feelings at the end of the show by the time it was all done, if that makes any sense. I know I've been talking for a million years, but if that makes any sense to you, that was a better turnabout for us, I think, for the third one.
Yeah, it makes quite a bit of sense when you look at it from that perspective of actually the show as a character. I would think that there's more opportunity to parody those sort of going in a contest ones.
Yes,
we've become huge fans of another reality show. You might The Quest.
Yes, yes.
We definitely are huge fans of them as well. And that show, again, it focuses sort of on a fiction in that it's in a big fantasy world, and these guys are, you know, they're almost LARPing to some degree, but they're still them. And I would say that, yeah, there's definitely an aspect of reality shows, Joe Schmo and stuff like The Quest, where when it's directed about an overarching concept versus just the interpersonal, there's a lot of room to play.
Yeah, and there's a lot of room for comedy and spoofing and parody, too, because, you know, the best thing, I think, that about our show has always been the archetypes, you know, taking the quintessential reality show contestants and boiling them down to a type and then just spoofing the shit out of those people. I mean, we did it early on with Hutch in the first one, Hutch. You know, and there's always a bully. And then, you know, at the end where we had Joe Newman, who played this amazing character called Carly, who was deaf, and she had an interpreter there with her. And we had Lorenzo Lamas as a real life celebrity playing himself. And there was so, you know, throughout all three seasons, there were these brilliant performances about these quintessential reality show types that show up, seem to show up in almost every reality show. There's always one of these. And it just, for me, that has always been the real true attraction of the show, is these amazing performances from these great improvisational comedians who are able to put out, you know, these tremendous moments that people can, you know, regardless of whether you buy into the show or not, you're going to see some really great stuff come out of these people.
Yeah,
so and the host, and the host too. The hosts are always good too on these shows. I forgot to mention that.
Who has the giant full-bodied Jake Montrose wife and tiger painting?
Well, I'm looking at it as we speak. I'll have
you
know.
Are you really?
Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It is on my wall as we speak. Yeah, that was one of those. You know, I don't take a lot of stuff from a lot of projects I work on. I'll try to take a little something, a little souvenir.
Sure.
I learned that from Adam West, who said he opened up his trunk on the last day of filming Batman and just stuffed it full of stuff. And he said, you never know when it's going to come in handy. And so I always grab something, whether it's, you know, from, you know, on Seth's set, I always take like the back of my my director's chair. It's got the name of the character and the name of the production and stuff on it. I mean, because when we did Ted and Ted 2 and A Million Ways to Die in the West, I mean, I just like to have that. That's my like my quintessential memory from those shows. And from Joe Schmo 3, it was the painting, which I always thought was hilarious. And I also have the vest that I wore in almost every scene, the sleeveless vest, of course. And I've got my badge. I've got my Jake Montrose badge that I wore around my neck. So those are my little keepsakes.
Didn't you tell the guys on the show didn't Jake tell them that he had painted that?
Yes. Yeah, because you remember, I also painted a picture for each of the remaining contestants at one point with their spirit animals.
Yes.
Because I consider myself quite the amateur painter. So
it wasn't just the giant full-body Jake Montrose painting, but the fact that straight-faced, you're like, oh, no, I painted that myself.
Yeah, it was me. It was me and my wife and a tiger. I took some liberties. I took some liberties. That's what I kept saying. Well, as if I was actually posing with a tiger at some point.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it was a good time.
We've discussed at length now the past. What do you got going on in the future? What's the current projects du jour that you can tell us about?
Well, of course, as always, my constant is the Hollywood Babylon podcast that I do with my buddy Kevin Smith, and we're going to be in your neck of the woods this fall. We're going to be in Philly and New York City in November. So if you're around any of those areas, if you've got listeners in any of those areas, I would love to have them come out and join us. You can go to csmod.com to get tickets for those shows. And also in the fall, I will be I make an appearance in one episode, soon to be in many more if it gets a second season. But my friend Seth MacFarlane's got a new show called The Orville that's going to be on Fox in the fall. And I play the bartender for the ship on that show. And it was one of the weirdest and greatest experiences of my life, which I can't really talk that much about why it was so weird, but you'll see when you see the episode. But it was a blast, and so I always love working with Seth, so that will be on in the fall as well.
I saw a teaser for The Orville. I was probably on a commercial, probably during Family Guy or something, and as a huge science fiction fan, it definitely will be a checkout, guaranteed. I hope he hits pay dirt with it, because again, it's rife for satire and parody, and I think Seth's sensibilities with that is going to go a long way.
You know, I think people will be surprised, because I know Fox, and understandably, is sort of selling it as, you know, Galaxy Quest as sort of like a spoof and a big satire of sci-fi, and there's certainly comedy, don't get me wrong, but Seth is a huge Star Trek The Next Generation fan.
Yes.
And he loves the whole universe, but primarily that iteration of Star Trek, and there's a lot more straightforward storytelling and science fiction in this series than a lot of people are, I think, will than ex- that they expect. So I think you will enjoy the comedy, but I think there's also some really good science fiction storytelling in this that people are going to get a kick out of. So I'm waiting. I mean, I'll be interested to see what people's reaction is to it.
That is fantastic. Well, is there any other links that we should tell people about that they might not know?
Just love to have people follow me at Twitter, because this is how things like this happen, is through the magic of Twitter. That's how we got together, boys. So go to @RalphGarment at Twitter, or I'm also the same on Instagram. And I thanks for inviting me on, fellas. It was a real blast.
Ralph, thank you so much for joining us. It was great having you on here.
Yeah, this has been a real treat, and we look forward to seeing you in the Orville, listening to Hollywood Babylon and all the other projects.
Thank you, boys.
All right. So I think that wraps us up, Mr. Rob. So why don't we say our goodbyes?
Okay. Goodbye. That's how we normally have to show
I
up.
Know. I just like I like getting you. So with that being said, thank you all for listening. Tell us what you think on all of the same places, on the Facebook, on the Twitter, STSTcast. Or email. You know all of the links. I'm not going to screw them up now. We have a guest. I have to look good. So with that, I'm James Hatton.
I'm Podcast Rob.
And who are you?
Ralph. And you are?
Oh, I'm Ralph Garman.
Yeah. And we will see you guys next time.
Later.
Hello.
Hello.
Why, hello there, hey. Sir.
Hello. How are you, James?
Doing well. Oh, he even knows my name. You are a professional.
Oh, it's not my first rodeo, cowboy.